You're listening to Seeing and Believing, a film and television podcast that searches for the sacred on screen. I'm Wade Bearden.
And I'm Kevin McLenathan. Wade, we're here in the middle of April, and yet we're just now getting to our Oscar discussion. The Oscars are in a couple of weeks. I'm really disoriented right now. I don't know which way is up.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of feels like something happened last year, Kevin, but I can't quite put my finger on it.
I'm trying my best not to put my finger on it.
Listeners, today we conclude our discussion of the Best Picture nominees with a review of Promising Young Woman from writer and director Emerald Fennell.
We're also going to be providing our little overview of the Oscar ceremony themselves, what picks we liked, which ones we didn't, and which ones we maybe predict are going to take home the statue on the big night. All that's coming up on this episode, episode 287 of Seeing and Believing.
You know, I actually wanted to meet you today to talk about something in particular. I did wonder. No one's heard from you in, like, forever. I wanted to talk to you about why I dropped out. Okay, sure. You remember what happened, right? Such a long time ago now.
I know, but you remember.
I mean, vaguely.
Do you ever think about it?
Why would I?
Right. Why would you?
So if a friend came to you now, came to your house and told you that they thought something bad had happened to them the night before.
Cassie!
Something bad.
It was years ago.
What would you say? What would you say?
Yes, listeners, this is episode 287 of Seeing and Believing. We're going to talk about our Academy Award picks a little bit later on in the show. I don't know if they're picks. I don't know if I have picks, but I definitely do have nominees that I hope will win, and then a lot of nominees that I hope don't win, Kevin. And there seems to be a trend that happens every year.
I've long since learned not to try to, you know, play any Oscar pools because I'm usually wrong with my predictions. I don't usually do that well. And with the year that 2020 was, and there being kind of a lot of dark horse nominees this time around, it seems like it's even more of a toss up than usual. So I'm staying far away from making any prognostications.
I might play the game where I do predict the films and then kind of tally up my score. And what I usually do is I'll print it out and I'll say which one I hope will win and which one I think will win. And usually those two are different. But at least I can put down the ones that I hope will win. And that makes me feel better about myself.
Probably makes you feel better about some of the terrible choices that the Academy eventually makes when they actually hand out the awards too. So there's that silver lining as well.
Oh man, look at us being a couple of grumps today. That's episode 287. Just us complaining about the Academy Awards. Well,
what are the Oscars if we don't complain about them, right?
Yeah,
that's what they're for.
No, it is. So in a little over a week, the 93rd Academy Awards ceremony, it does take place. Feels a little weird that it's happening in April. And Kevin, we are gearing up by closing out our discussion of the Best Picture nominees over the course of the year. We've talked in some form about every film in that category save one. Emerald Fennell's Promising Young Woman. We rectify that today. Now, I do want to note that listeners should be aware that the subject matter of this film does deal with issues of sexual assault, and it might be disturbing and a little bit difficult for some viewers. So I'm just going to put that out there in case there are any young ears in the audience. Here is the film's official synopsis. Everyone said Cassie, played by Carrie Mulligan, was a promising young woman until a mysterious event abruptly derailed her career. But nothing in Cassie's life is what it appears to be. By night, Cassie performs a ritual of her own invention, going to bars and dance clubs alone in the wee hours. She pretends to be dangerously intoxicated, helpless to defend herself from anyone who might wish her harm. Inevitably, There's a man who decides to make sure she gets home safely, yet he also inevitably lets his own desires take priority over Cassie's well-being, not realizing that he's simply the latest to fall prey to Cassie's nefarious schemes. He's about to be taught a lesson he's unlikely to forget anytime soon. Eventually, an unexpected encounter is about to give Cassie a chance to right the wrongs of the past, as she's pulled back toward her own traumatic experiences that forever changed the course of her life. The film also stars Bo Burnham, Allison Brie, Connie Britton, and Adam Brody. It's written and directed by Emerald Fennell. Kevin, given the subject matter of Promising Young Woman, the movie could not come at a more important time. As we begin our discussion of the film, I'd like to first pose this question to you. Just what do you make of how the movie uses its distinct, loud style to tell this story? Do you think it's effective or, in the end, ultimately distracting to the subject matter?
I mean, the style, I'm assuming the kind of candy-colored visuals and the pop-inflected soundtrack, like you get Britney Spears, you get Paris Hilton, you get a lot of what's popularly, or at least used to popularly be called bubblegum pop, and that's kind of this whole aesthetic that Fennell uses to act as a counterpoint to the essential darkness of the story. This is more or less a rape revenge thriller, right? This is a kind of, in some ways, an answer to the often male directed movies where a woman is the victim of sexual violence in some way, and she spends the entire movie kind of taking back some of the power by inflicting violence upon the people who first violated her. And they're often extremely violent, extremely explicit, and aren't typically movies that I want to be watching. There's just not very much about them that I really want to be putting into my head. And so it's interesting to see this kind of aesthetic applied to similar subject matter. And it's also interesting to see the places that Fennell takes it that stand in some ways in stark contrast to those other films. So I think that the aesthetic is interesting and works as far as it goes. I'm not a huge fan of this film, and it's less to do with the film's visuals or the directorial choices and mostly to do with the script. I can imagine a movie like this, it's an interesting idea, and I can imagine there being a version of this idea being put on screen that I would like a lot better, but I just think that the screenplay here is so broad that I don't think it ends up working in the end for me. I'm curious to know what your thoughts are, though.
Yeah, I think the script is the weakest aspect of the film, and I think that the final act of the movie is what does the film in for me. And I think that I wouldn't say pulls its punches. I'm just not really sure where it's intending to go, and when it does land there, I felt like the story was a little bit incomplete. So I do agree with you there. I think the aesthetic and the style of the movie says something about just the entire issue. And you mentioned Britney Spears. There's this real big scene and an orchestra rendition of Britney Spears' song Toxic is playing in the background. And it's seeming to suggest that even this, what you call bubblegum aesthetic, is a product of this culture that devalues women. And to see that aesthetic kind of flipped a bit, I think works. Now, like I mentioned, I think the script doesn't fully subvert those ideas. And I wouldn't say that this film in the end is almost too different than this subgenre that you described earlier. It's less violent. it's less explicit, but I'm not sure the ideas of vigilante violence and sexual assault are kind of played out like they could be. Now, at the same time, this issue really is important to the movie. It wears its heart on its sleeve about the entire Me Too movement. And so it does have, I think, a message worth hearing. Like you said, I would have liked to see the story go in some different places or at least be refined a bit more.
Yeah, I think refined, it's interesting because this is not a film that's not, it's not trying to be refined. Like it's not, Fennell, as both a writer and director, doesn't particularly care about coddling her audience's sensibilities. She doesn't particularly care about whether or not she's playing by certain rules or not being transgressive. There are a few points of this movie that are genuinely transgressive, or at least kind of don't go down a more conventional road that you might expect. And I think that's an approach that deserves some credit. For me, though, it's less that I don't think that it's well observed enough for its punches to really land. It's got that anger bubbling underneath it, but it feels kind of like it's angry at a cartoon version of the issues that it's trying to address. And by that, I mean the male characters in this film who are the targets of Cassie's plans. It's not enough for them to just be bad. They have to be almost like caricatures. And I don't know that the film is well served by that. Not because I think that these characters are deserving of more compassion from the audience. It's more that they just aren't really recognizable as anything except two-dimensional cardboard stand-ups of villains. And I think that for especially the twists that come at the end of this movie to really have the gut punch feel that Fennell's going for, you really have to see these abusers as people, not just as monsters or as cartoons, but as scarily real men who have very real world analogs. And that doesn't really hold true for me. There's, you know, the men in this film, they don't seem particularly recognizable as people. They seem almost like buffoons or again, I just come back to the word cartoons, and I just don't, I think it's easy to have them as boo hiss villains, but I think that Fennell really wants us to confront the fact that self-proclaimed nice guys really aren't that nice. And I guess I would have found that more compelling if the men that she had put on screen actually resembled some of the men like that I know in real life. And to not be brought to that point of confrontation with this film, I wonder if that's a flaw with it.
Yeah. Well, we should point out too that the casting is very deliberate in this film, and that a number of the individuals who transgress in this film are characters who play the nice guy or the dork in other films and television shows. And so I mentioned Adam Brody. You also have Mick Lovin, who's in this movie.
Christopher Mintz-Plasse.
Yes, he's here. You have a couple of the quote-unquote good guys from the Veronica Mars series. One of them includes Max Greenfield and then Chris Lowell. And so there's something that's said about, okay, these guys on the outside, they seem like everything is fine, but they're corrupted from the inside. And I appreciated that casting, but there are some choices, like you said, at the end, which kind of throws a lot of that out the window. And I think it makes it makes the film easier, right? So if someone is not just someone who made a mistake once or twice, but is just an absolute villain, then it just makes the whole story a little bit easier. And I'm not sure if that's the best place to go. There are some creative ways I think the movie uses the acts of the film. And so there's, you know, part one, part two, and I'm thinking, okay, we're going to end with part three. It's going to be act three of the movie. But part three comes in the middle of the film when things seem to be resolved. And then four and five take the story even deeper. And I think that's a creative element here. I also like some of the compositions. During a large portion of the film, the camera will actually frame actors with a large amount of headspace. And at one point, there's this I was almost startling. It's a tension grabbing shot of a woman in power who has been perpetuating this behavior towards women. And above her is this painting of an old white gentleman, and he's above her. But most of the time, these characters are framed with a lot of headspace. There's this kind of crushing burden on a lot of these individuals, with the exception of some of the villains. They don't seem to live with a lot of that burden, with a lot of that headspace. And I think that's kind of a fascinating choice. And I appreciate a number of those compositions to further kind of reinforce the pushiness, the style of this film and the message it's trying to tell.
Yeah, Fennell, she knows how to frame a shot for sure. I like how she often frames Cassie, dead center in the frame of, you know, almost meticulous. It kind of feels a lot like a Wes Anderson shot where everything is arranged just so. Often the scenery behind her in the background is very, very meticulous. She works at a coffee shop where there's kind of this blue wall decoration in the background, and Fennell frames Cassie directly in front of that. So it almost looks like she's painted on, like a painted figurine on a teacup or something. It's very, it's a very delicate kind of mise-en-scene used throughout this film. The kind of very ornate surroundings at her childhood home. She still lives with her parents, and her parents kind of live in this very almost over the top decoration. You know, there's this giant baby portrait on the wall. There are these chandeliers hanging down. And Fennell uses those things to suggest how Cassie is all too happy to place herself kind of in that environment, because her whole mode of operation involves playing on how men underestimate her and try to take advantage of her, because they, in their minds, she's something very delicate herself, someone who's a thing who can just be kind of arranged just so, used and then discarded. And Fennell's ability to suggest that through the visuals is really nice. And it's part of why I kind of wish that, like you were saying earlier, the screenplay had been refined a little bit more, because I think that Fennell has the directorial chops to tell this kind of story. I just don't think that the particulars of the script really feel all that well considered. And that doesn't go just for the portraits of the abusers. I just think the way some of the dialogue is written, it feels kind of almost sitcom-y. The dialogue between Cassie and Bo Burnham's character, Ryan, they kind of have this meet cute and this romance that is a subplot and acts again as a counterpoint to the revenge plot, that it's fun, but it feels a little bit canned, I guess. And I wish that the writing were on par with the directing, because that gulf just became easier and easier to see as the film went on, and ended up making me feel like I'd watched something very, very visually well considered, but a little bit half baked conceptually.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of these performances I think are really good. I love the chemistry between Carey Mulligan and Bo Burnham. And I like Bo Burnham a lot. I think he directed one of the best films of the decade. I think I had it like number 10 or 11 or something like that, eighth grade. And I think he's a fantastic actor. I think he's really funny. Carey Mulligan, I mean, we've talked about her a lot. She's fantastic. And I loved a lot of their scenes together. And it made me wish that they were just in a straightforward rom-com. Like, can we just put them two in a straightforward rom-com? And I'd watch, you know, I'd watch that. I'd eat that up. There are some really great scenes between them. And so we get a lot of, I feel like this film has so many fantastic qualities. So, you know, don't get me wrong when I talk about the script, but there are a lot of, I think, great moments. The film is, you know, it's a black comedy. I feel like it's pretty humorous in scenes. It's pretty intense. I was actually on the edge of my seat in many scenes. So there is this quality of, within the movie, of producing this just emotion, this sort of raw kind of emotion or power or anger or frustration. And so in that sense, I think the film does succeed because it does make you feel those things. And, one of the more gripping watches that I've had, you know, in the past recent months.
I keep coming back to the feeling, what the word I used at the beginning of this review, which was broad. I think that this is a movie that in a lot of ways is pitched very broadly, and it made me feel like the more gripping parts, I felt a little bit, it just felt a little bit tidy. In the ways they kind of set up these plot dynamics only to knock them down. I'm thinking about, Kitty Green's The Assistant, which I had on my top 10 of 2020, and just how subtly it also evoked some of the same themes of men abusing their power, of sexual assault, of how young women, especially young women, kind of find themselves caught up in the gears of a system that really is only interested in exploiting them and does not want to listen to what they have to say. And I remember the anxiety I felt watching The Assistant, the scene with Matthew McFadyen's HR representative, where it's very blasé, and yet the sinister qualities of that scene came out. And that's kind of the sharpness of observation that I was looking for and missing in Promising Young Woman. The anger is very well earned, obviously, but it doesn't feel like, it feels like it's anger directed towards almost an abstraction, rather an anger directed towards more concrete, observed phenomenon that are experienced in the world every day. And I feel like that's something that The Assistant was able to evoke for me and was much more gripping for that. Whereas Promising Young Woman felt like it's maybe cathartic to watch in the moment, but it's not really a film that I'm particularly interested in revisiting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I totally get that. And I think probably the last thing I'll say about this movie here in the podcast is some of these themes and ideas. And I started noticing this trend in some films, some very thoughtful films, since It Follows. And it's the idea of how powerful sex is. And you almost sense this moving toward a more conservative approach of, consensual or not, sex impacts us in deep ways. And It is powerful, and we see that in It Follows, right? This idea that sex passes something down to each individual, and it kind of floats above this scene as well. And the way that sex is used to hurt and devalue individuals, and it pushes me, and it reminds me of just of the protection of sex within that you know, marital relationship. And maybe I'm kind of going farther than the film itself is going, but it definitely brings forth these ideas that the sexual revolution in the 60s didn't get it right. And we're still wrestling with this question, and it's a big question. And a movie like this talks about some of the issues that we're trying to work through and the trauma that's been invoked over the centuries. So definitely a lot to think about, you know, with this movie.
Well, interesting thoughts for sure. And definitely a film that has been encouraging a lot of discussion. I've seen lots of people talking about this film. So I was looking forward to seeing it and was glad to have a chance to discuss it on the podcast, even if, you know, ultimately I ended up on kind of like a naysayer role with the film as a whole. I'm curious to know what our listeners thought as well. Listeners, if you've had a chance to catch up with Promising Young Woman in advance of the Oscars and you have thoughts about it and thoughts about what Wade and I have had to say about on the show today, definitely let us know. We're curious to hear what you think of it. You can always email us at seeingandbelievingcapc@gmail.com or tweet us at seebelievepod on Twitter.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
But for now, maybe that's a good way to transition from this particular Oscar-nominated film into a discussion of the Oscar nominations at large, Wade. Like you said, the ceremony at long last is around the corner. It got delayed, obviously, for pretty good reasons, but it's finally here. And there is a lot to talk about. So I'm kind of curious to know. We've kind of touched a few things related to the nominations since they were announced. I know that you said that you were pretty pleased overall with the quality of the Best Picture nominees. So maybe we'll start there and run down the list of nominations for Best Picture. We've got The Father, Judas and the Black Messiah, Mank, Minari, Nomadland, Promising Young Woman, Sound of Metal, and The Trial of the Chicago 7. That's the slate that we're working with. And yeah, I don't know. I'm curious to hear your thoughts about that field, Wade, since you know, were pretty positive on it overall. Which ones do you like? Which ones do you dislike? And which ones do you hope will be recognized on the night?
Yeah, well, I think the only film that I kind of just dislike from that list is Mank. And I've disliked it more and more as time has passed by. We just reviewed, you know, Promising Young Woman. And so that one, I think there's a lot to commend about it. Not surprised that it is here. And all the others I think are really good. I mean, Nomadland is my favorite movie of 2020. And Sound of Metal, I think, was number three. And Minari was on my top 10. So I would love to see those films win it out. I wouldn't have a problem with any of those. And also Judas and the Black Messiah, The Father, all good films that we could recommend too.
Yeah. I didn't get a chance to review Mank when it came out on the show. I think that was you had a guest on to help you talk about that, because that was during my sabbatical because of a certain baby. So, but I did have a chance to catch up with it, and I'm with you. It's not surprising, I guess, that it got nominated, since it's a black and white movie about the golden age of Hollywood. Yeah. I mean, everyone knew that was going to get a nomination pretty much from the time it was announced. But it's disappointing to me, I guess, that it's gotten as much attention as it has, because I'm with you, Wade. I was really underwhelmed with Mank, and so I'm very much rooting against it for the ceremony. I'm really looking forward to an awards night where Minari takes it home. Like, I think that's a great movie, and it would just be so nice to see something you know, that small and understated win out is over the more flashy stuff like Mank and the Trial of the Chicago Seven, which just not all that exciting. I would also accept Sound of Metal, I guess. If I can't have exactly what I want, Sound of Metal would also be a very, very fine choice.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, overall, I'm pretty pleased. I feel like most of the time they're just like half of the movies are movies I just don't enjoy. And so I think the slate is pretty good. Let's move on to some performances. I think the nominations here are pretty good in a lot of these roles. So for actress in a leading role, we have Viola Davis in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Andra Day in The United States versus Billie Holiday. Have not seen that movie. Vanessa Kirby in Pieces of a Woman, Frances McDormand in Nomadland, and then Carey Mulligan in Promising Young Woman. Kevin, what do you think about that? What do you think about that batch of nominees?
This is actually a category that I'm a little shamefaced about because I haven't seen two of the five films that have actresses nominated for. I have not gotten a chance to catch up with The United States versus Billie Holiday or Pieces of a Woman, so I can't really comment on Andra Day or Vanessa Kirby. I'm a fan of Kirby. I think she's a tremendous actress, and I'm certainly interested to see Pieces of a Woman. Of the three that I have seen, I really like Viola Davis from Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I think that that's a performance that could have just been really big and full of, I don't know, I can see a version of that film having Ma Rainey herself, who is, you know, that's who Davis plays. I can see a version of that where Ma Rainey is just this big bombastic role and just the actor in that role just chewing up the scenery. Davis doesn't. She actually kind of, in a lot of ways, underplays Ma Rainey. And I think that it makes it a very interesting role to watch. So that's probably my pick of the ones that I've seen. And it would be hard for me to see how Day and Kirby would top that one, but I'm open to an upset once I do get a chance to catch up with those two films.
Yeah, yeah. I think Davis probably has one of the best performances here. The other one would be Frances McDormand, and I think she just carries Nomadland. And so, yeah, those were really good performances. Now, in Best Actor in a Leading Role, we have Riz Ahmed for Sound of Metal, Chadwick Boseman for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Anthony Hopkins, The Father, Gary Oldman in Mank, and Steven Yeun in Minari. Take out Gary Oldman, and we've got a really good batch here, and it's difficult to choose one over the other. They're all so good.
Oh, man. Words almost can't express how bitter I am that Gary Oldman is in this category. I think I don't think Mank is a very good movie, but I think Oldman is actually pretty bad in it. I don't think he gives a very interesting performance. And I think the way that he plays Mank is a lot of very broad sort of actor playing tipsy sort of role. And I think it's kind of a shockingly bad performance, if I'm being perfectly honest. And I'll be honest here, it might be because I really, really wanted Delroy Lindo to get some recognition at long last for his one just incredible performance in Da Five Bloods by Spike Lee. I can't remember if I've actually said this on the podcast, but I think Lindo's performance is the performance of the year. I don't think anybody else comes close to touching him. It just seems not just that it's technically a great performance, just in terms of what he's doing as an actor with everything. But I just think in terms of the way it's written and the way that he taps into these really interesting contradictions in the character of Paul, this African-American man who's a diehard Trump supporter, and the way that interacts with other aspects of his identity and his history, I just think is spellbinding. And I desperately wish he were in this. Since I can't have that, though, I really do also like Chadwick Boseman in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. He's also pretty astounding. Riz Ahmed in any other year would probably be my pick. He had the bad luck of a really strong competition in 2020.
I guess I thought that Chadwick Boseman would be in supporting role when I saw the film. He is in leading role. And I could see that too. I think he's the one to beat. I think his performance is fantastic. And I'm not sure if I've mentioned it on the show, but he gives this speech where he essentially curses God for all the things that have happened in his life. And it's a speech. And just, you know, he passed away this year. I think he'll win, and deservedly so. This won't be just an award they give him because he did pass away. Like, he does deserve this. I like Riz Ahmed a lot. And like you said, any other year, he would be at the top, and Steven Yeun too. But I think Boseman is definitely the person to beat. So I'm thinking through, there's a lot of categories I guess we could go through. We probably should at least talk about best director, because that's an important category, and it's one that I'm always interested in just talking through and thinking through. And I'm going to go through the nominees right now. We have Thomas Vinterberg, who directed Another Round. I haven't seen that film, Kevin, but I know you have and you liked it a lot. David Fincher make. I like David Fincher a lot, but I'm in this place now where every time I see his name, I'm just not happy. And that's a weird thing, because any other year I'd be like, yes, yes. And I think, you know, Social Network should have won Best Picture the year it was produced. You got Lee Isaac Chung for Minari, Chloe Zhao for Nomadland, my favorite film of the year, as I mentioned earlier, Promising Young Woman by Emerald Fennell. It's got to be, for me, Nomadland. I would also be really, really, really excited if Lee Isaac Chung won. That would be amazing. So just pulling for one of those two films.
Yeah, I if I had to make a prediction, I would say that the statue is Chloe Zhao is to lose. Like, I think she's the pretty clearly the front runner. Nomadland has really gotten a lot of appreciation. And I think that I like her as a director. I'm not sure that I kind of feel like her winning for Nomadland is kind of like Martin Scorsese winning for The Departed. It's a fine movie. It's maybe not her best, or I would argue that it's definitely not her best. I'm all in on Lee Isaac Chung for Minari. I just think that it's a tremendous film. His directing in it is tremendous, and I would be very pumped if he won. I share your thoughts on David Fincher. Emerald Fennell, you know, I spent the entire first half of this episode kind of bad-mouthing Promising Young Woman, but I do think that the directing in it is interesting. So I wouldn't be sad if she or Thomas Vinterberg won as well, just as long as Fincher kind of gets his wrist slapped for turning in Mank, you know?
Oh, man.
I guess this is turning into the David Fincher hate hour. I don't know that we intended it that way, but, you know, that's just the way the wind is blowing.
Oh, man. Well, it's hard because, you know, I don't know how many films, it was 11, or we did our countdown, our favorite David Fincher films earlier in the summer. And I talked about, hey, I like him a lot. I was very interested in Mank, very excited about Mank, and just, you know, completely let down. So, but no, I still love you, Fincher, and we're hoping good things in your future. Kevin, are there any other categories that we want to discuss before closing this shop up?
I did want to give a call out for Best Supporting Actor. I think that's also a pretty strong category, give or take a Sacha Baron Cohen, which is sort of the, he's the David Fincher of this category. Oh, no. I don't really know what he's doing in there. it's a little bit like the Gary Oldman role in actor. I don't think it's a very good performance. But I'd say other than that, though, this is a really strong slate. I'm leaning towards Lakeith Stanfield for Judas and the Black Messiah. I think it's I had a lot of great things to say for Stanfield in that film when we reviewed it on the show, and I think he's just really great. As for whether he'll win, I'm not sure. This is an interesting category, which is why I brought it up, Wade. I'm curious to know your thoughts, because I could really see... I don't know that Leslie Odom Jr. for One Night in Miami is going to win, but I could see any of the other four taking it home. It's pretty... There's some stiff competition in this category.
Yeah, there is. And my pick is, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Paul Racy. He is, of course, the supporting actor in Sound of Metal. I think he's so good. And I did a podcast where with Screenfish and Steve Norton, where we counted down our favorite scenes of the year, 2020. And his scene with Riz Ahmed, where they eventually part ways, is my favorite of the year. And he talks about the kingdom of God. And I mean, there's just, it surprised me. And I think whenever I was looking at the list, I saw his name. He was one of the first nominations that I saw when the nominations were released. And it was just like, oh man, like this is things are going really well this year for him to be on this list. I just didn't expect it. And so I would just absolutely love for him to win. It is weird with Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield being on here for the same movie. And it's just like, how do you choose? And I think Stanfield should, he should be in lead role. I think he should. And so because of that, I think Daniel Kaluuya will win this. I think he will win this one. But man, Paul Racy, I would love for him to take this.
that's a gutsy pick, because I could see it going either way. Judas and the Black Messiah with two nominees in the same category might end up splitting the vote.
Yes.
And then Paul might actually be able to, walk up that split vote and get to the awards podium on the night just because of that. But I don't know. It's going to be interesting. I don't know if I'll actually end up watching the Oscars live, but I will be very interested to see who wins out in this particular category.
Mm-hmm. I try to watch it live. It's usually a lot of fun. It does go on for too long, but I'm hoping this year things will be a little more succinct. I don't know how they're going to do it. I assume it'll be people kind of video conferencing in, because that's what the Golden Globes did. So I don't know. That has an opportunity to be kind of fun and to be kind of different and perhaps take out all of those weird jokes and skits that are not funny and just focus on the awards. So we'll see. Listeners, that is coming to you April 25th, 2021. The 93rd Academy Awards. Let us know your favorite movies of the year, your favorite picks. We'd love to hear those. And I don't know, maybe we should even start this little game where we send in our picks and then we see who got it right. That would be a lot of fun. But for now, that is the end of our episode. Once again, reach out to us on Twitter at CBelievePod, at CBelievePod. If you have comments about the show, you can also email us seeingandbelievingcapc@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to this week's episode. It's brought to you by ChristandPopCulture.com. Our producer is Jonathan Clausen, who every week helps us to search for the sacred on screen. I'm Wade Bearden. My co-host is Kevin McLenathan. And until next time, this is Seeing and Believing. We'll see you later.
You have been listening to Seeing and Believing, an official production of the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Please rate and review the show in iTunes and check out our other shows at christandpopculture.com/network. Theme music by Alexander Osborne and Lindsay Miz, used under Creative Commons License 3.0.